Welcome to Public Policy This Week, a well-rounded weekly discussion of policy issues that frame today's American experience.
Good morning. It is Friday, November 4th, and you've joined us for Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio.
Public Policy This Week runs the gamut on policy subjects, from neighborhood concerns to municipal, state, and national level issues. Everything is fair game. Our objective is civil, thoughtful dialogue about important public policy issues that convey ideas and solutions to move society forward.
So hosting today's program is Bruce Moreland. Bruce co-hosted the KYMN Climate Show with Alan Anderson for 4 years and is quite active in Citizens Climate Lobby. Bruce also has a monthly column in both the Faribault and Northfield newspapers.
And the man sitting across from me is John Olson, the force behind the microphone, who's well known as the host of National Security This Week, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. right here on KYMN.
Today on Public Policy This Week, we're going to talk about nuclear energy, its history, controversies, and the current and future place nuclear power has in our power infrastructure.
I'm really looking forward to this show. At the June 2022 Citizens Climate Lobby meeting, we were given a nice overview of nuclear energy. But the nuclear fear industry, as described by Kerry Emanuel in an article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists in November, has poisoned the conversations, perhaps less so in my side of the world, but we're all apolitical here. But it was interesting to watch the reaction of that crowd.
It's an important topic to discuss. So, Bruce, why don't you go ahead and start us off with our introductions?
I can do that. Our first guest for this important show on nuclear power is Don Harker. Don has worked in the industry for over 40 years. His experience includes being an officer in the U.S. Navy Nuclear Submarine Service, a senior reactor simulator instructor for Westinghouse, various roles at Exelon Nuclear, and over 20 years in the energy consulting business. He earned a Master of Management degree from Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management and a Bachelor of Science degree from the U.S. Naval Academy. Don Harker has consulted on a wide variety of nuclear power projects all around the world.
And our second guest is Dr. Josh Jarrell. Dr. Josh Jarrell has been working in nuclear energy research and development since earning his doctorate in nuclear engineering from Texas A&M in 2010. He currently works at Idaho National Laboratory as a senior technical advisor for the Department of Energy's Advanced Nuclear Fuel Availability Program. Over the past 5 years, he's also managed a pyrochemistry and molten salt systems department, as well as a used fuel management department at Idaho National Laboratory. Before joining the Idaho National Laboratory, he worked for 7 years at Oak Ridge National Laboratory as an R&D staff member with a focus on modeling and simulation of nuclear reactors, as well as spent fuel management. Gentlemen, let's go ahead and get started. I'll ask this first question of both of you. Either of you can get us started today. It's a little bit basic, but probably worth asking to put all of us on the same page as we begin our discussions this morning. So what exactly is a nuclear reactor? How does it work? What kind of power does it produce, and how does it do so?
I'll take a crack at starting that, John.
Okay.
I mean, basically, a nuclear reactor is another way, the way it's used currently in this country is another way to heat water. You know, if we all remember back to high school physics and E equals MC squared, you know, it basically says that energy is equal to matter times some constant. Well, there are certain substances such as uranium, thorium, and plutonium that are inherently a little bit unstable. And when we hit those substances, those atoms, with a neutron, they break in two. And the energy released helps produce heat, and we transfer that heat in a nuclear reactor to the water. There are two types of reactors currently in use in the U.S. There's boiling water reactors, where that heated water goes directly to a steam turbine, much like a coal plant or a gas-fired combined cycle plants, or a pressurized water reactor, where that water goes to an intermediate heat exchanger and then heats other water that is turned to steam to turn the steam turbine. So that, in a nutshell, is what's going on in a nuclear power plant.
Josh, anything to add on that?
No, I think that's a great description. You know, when I think about what a nuclear reactor is, I'm thinking it's basically a heat source. You just need something to heat up the water that turns the steam, that turns the turbine, that generates the electricity. It just turns out with nuclear reactors, you're using that splitting of normally the uranium atom, that fissioning, they call it, to release that energy. And that process, fortunately, is really energy dense. So you, in very small amounts of space, you can generate a lot of heat and energy. And so it's a really effective process for generating energy and electricity to put on the grid and power your homes.
I think I read somewhere that something like 8,000 times more energy produced from a nuclear plant than from fossil fuels. Is that about right?
Yeah, it's incredibly energy dense. So let me just bring up, nuclear fuel is not a liquid. It's actually a solid. So it's not the green ooze you might see on a popular cartoon. And so in a very small amount of this solid fuel, maybe the tip of your finger, you have as much energy as a ton of coal or 120 gallons of oil. So it's really, really energy dense. It's really amazing.
Very cool. All right. We hear all the time about the dangers of nuclear power, right? And I'm kind of cognizant of how weird it is that we're spending so much time on the dangers of something compared to what we did in 1750 when we started burning coal and nobody noticed that we were going to destroy the atmosphere while we did that. So I'm curious what some of the sources of the dangers are from nuclear power. What are the actual dangers? And how safe are they compared, and nuclear power plants as a whole? And I know we're going to probably have to dip into the different generations of design a little bit to understand how that safety has evolved.
I mean, when I think of nuclear power, and I think danger can be a loaded word in that it leads you to an emotional argument. I think that the aspects of nuclear power that give people pause are, one, there's ionizing radiation, which, can affect your DNA, cause cell mutations, as we saw in the early 50s, atomic era B-movies, the attack of the 50-foot woman, things like that. There's those type of things. The second is proliferation of nuclear weapons, which is very real. In a nuclear reactor, you can create substances that can then be further processed through a very technology complex process to produce material for nuclear weapons. And the third being that we've created a substance that has a very long, in comparison to people's lives, almost infinite lifespan. So the ionizing radiation, people talk about that, but yet in the medical field, ionizing radiation is used to, help treat cancer, create x-rays, things like that. People don't seem to have that concern there. When you go to the dentist's office, you're being subjected to ionizing radiation. The nuclear proliferation aspect is done through international safeguards and engineering processes. And then the production of long waste, which we'll get into later, people look at long-lived nuclear waste as a problem, but yet, plastic may have a longer lifespan than nuclear waste. So when you talk about the dangers of it, you have to say relative to what. If you look at most industrial safety measures, nuclear power always scores very high as a safety record.
Yeah, I'll just add very quickly. Bruce and I were talking before we came on the radio this morning. I read an article in preparation for today's show that discussed that the world was introduced to nuclear power through the detonation of two atomic bombs at the end of World War II. And that sort of colors a lot of people's perspectives on what nuclear power is. And then we've had a couple of significant accidents, like Chernobyl, as a great example, that highlights some of the dangers. Now, that was probably not a great design, that particular nuclear power plant. But Bruce brings up a great point about what are the actual dangers of nuclear power. And Josh, maybe you can further comment.
Yeah, so I think, you know, the potential dangers of the reactors are very similar to what's been brought up. I mean, there it is a radioactive material, so it does release radiation, and you need to control that. But I do think there's sort of a fear as it pertains to that nuclear reactors could look like nuclear weapons or something like that. And that really isn't the case. You know, just the engineering of a reactor and what the material is and how it operates. I mean, there's sort of a night and day differences between weapons and reactors. And I still think there's some perpetual concern around a nuclear reactor being somewhat like a nuclear weapon. That's just not the case. And so I do think there's, you know, you have, you know, material that you have to properly manage, just like any other engineering process, any other energy source. You need to, you know, make sure that the public is safe, that the workers in the facilities are safe. And fortunately, I just maybe note that the nuclear industry in this country is very well regulated. We have a very strong independent regulator, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They've been, you know, making sure that nuclear reactors are safe in this country for 50, you know, several decades. And we've learned a lot on sort of as we've gone along on the best way to safely operate these plants. And I think we've done an excellent job. I think the track record shows that from a, you know, a danger to the public or even to the workers on our sites, you know, it's a great track record.
One of the problems that we often run into in our news cycle is that when an airplane crashes, it crashes every hour on the hour for the next week. And our mind is set to hear that information as if it was fresh each time. And so we develop an exaggerated sense of how dangerous these things are. And I think it's the same with nuclear power. You know, every time an incident happens, we hear it over and over and over, and then people whip out those old grade B movies, and we get a lot of our information from those movies, unfortunately. So is there anything, I mean, do we have any numbers that we can put on this? I saw a figure, for example, once that said that the number of deaths per petajoule was much lower for nuclear than it was for, say, carbon fuels. Do you guys have any sense of that?
In preparation for the show, I looked up, you know, I mean, I think they compare, like, brown coal, light coal, oil, the deaths per unit of energy produced for, say, brown coal, maybe 32 deaths per year, whereas nuclear power, solar power and wind are significantly less than one. So if you use that as the metric, you know, nuclear power is once again just a solution to the current problems that we're facing as far as climate change.
I know that when we heard about nuclear power at the CCL convention, that was part of the reason. Is we were, you know, a wealthy society has a lot of watts per person. That's what makes them wealthy. And if we're going to replace a lot of energy, we're going to have something like nuclear. I was at a piece. Well, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, you were talking about in the U.S., you know, that how it, nuclear power came into our consciousness through the end of World War II, the development of the Manhattan Project, you know, the proliferation of B movies. Unfortunately, the China Syndrome movie came out just as the TMI accident happened. So there's always been this, I think, tenuous link to nuclear weapons, which is not true. But if you look at other countries, specifically Canada now, which don't have a link to a nuclear weapons program at all, and the younger generation, they are developing nuclear power in right now, hand over fist. They are a significant force in the world's development of nuclear power for the future.
I think on that point, Don, I think I just read an article where Canada is putting, I think, a $930 million initial investment into developing more reactor power. Is that about right?
Yep, that's true. That's specifically, I think, for the SMR that they're building at the Darlington site. We'll get into it later, a GE Hitachi model. But they're doing other things as far as small modular reactors, which we'll talk about in the future for process heat, you know, to power gold mines, to extract tar sands. So when we talk about nuclear power, we're always talking from the U.S. construct and how we've grown up with it. Other countries, France, Canada, they don't have that construct.
Yeah.
Okay, gentlemen, I have a question that I mentioned this show yesterday at my Rotary meeting that we were going to talk about nuclear power. And after the meeting, I had somebody come running up to me and said, well, you know, the nuclear industry just produces these, you know, tons and tons of nuclear waste. So we need to straighten that out. So how is nuclear waste currently stored and how much is actually out there right now? And then what kinds of dangers exist from storing it, storing this nuclear waste?
Sure, I'll take the first shot at that one. So you know, nuclear waste is a byproduct of nuclear power. Again, we've been operating plants for decades in this country. We generate, you know, a substantial amount of electricity from nuclear power, something on the order of about 20%. And so, and we've been doing that for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 decades. And so the nice thing, you know, one of the things I'd sort of caveat nuclear waste is when we put in nuclear fuel to a reactor, it comes out of the reactor. It looks about the same, but it's more radioactive. And that's the nuclear waste that you're worried about. We are basically managing all of the waste from a nuclear reactor. You know, there are a lot of other energy sources, you know, that don't do that. You know, they release their waste to the environment. We do not. Every stick of waste that we've ever generated, we currently know are managing safely without risk to the public. And so I think it's important when we talk about nuclear waste is to understand we've been doing this for a long time. We've safely been storing and managing this material without risk to the public. So that's maybe the baseline, I'd say, is I think it's something to be sort of highlighted that we're managing our waste instead of releasing it directly to the environment. As far as the amount, though, we have been generating tons of spent fuel over the last 60 years or so. We actually have about 90,000 metric tons of spent fuel generated. But, you know, I brought up earlier how energy dense nuclear is. So if you actually look at the whole volume of the spent fuel as is right now, we have on the order of, for all the spent fuel that's generated for the last 60 years to power this country, if you look at the volume of it, it's about a football field that's 30 feet tall. That's it from a volume perspective. I mean, that's it. I mean, for 60 years. I mean, and so now, of course, we don't store it on a football field stacked up because it is radioactive. But, you know, it's incredibly energy dense. So you don't need, you know, you're not looking at just mounds of nuclear waste out there. We fortunately in this country, like I said, we have a good regulator to make sure we handle it safely, and we have been handling it safely for 6 decades. So let me, and then maybe the details of how we manage it safely. So each reactor generates spent fuel, and these again are solid materials. Nuclear fuel solid, so it goes into the reactor. It's in there for maybe 3 or 5 years, depending on the model of the reactor. It comes out. It looks geometry wise very similar. But it's radioactive now, and it generates radiation and heat. And so initially, it'll come out of the reactor and be placed into a swimming pool, essentially. It's a steel-lined spent fuel pool. And so basically, the fuel goes into that water pool. They call it wet storage. And it ensures that the water shields the fuel from the workers in the facilities and the public. So it's preventing radiation from reaching them. And it also keeps the fuel cool. And because the pool, you may change the temperature and it cools the fuel off. Because the fuel, as it comes out of the reactor, is still generating a lot of heat. So it has to be cooled off. After about, you know, at a minimum 3 to 5 years in the pool, the fuel has reached a temperature and a heat generation rate. It's low enough that they can move it out of what they call wet storage to dry storage. And so all of the nuclear plants that are in the U.S., I think all of them, maybe there's one that's not quite there yet, but has dry storage at their facility. And these dry storage systems are massive, robust structures. So you put spent fuel into these right circular cylinders, canisters, right? Think of a can, but they're very big, and they're stainless steel, and they're maybe 6 feet in diameter and 15 feet tall, so very large structures. And then you move those canisters that have the spent fuel in them into these very robust dry storage systems. And these dry storage systems are made of concrete, stainless steel, lead, other things. And basically they're set outside, essentially, on a concrete pad. And they basically are stored safely, effectively, efficiently. And those systems prevent radiation from going to the public, prevent any release of nuclear material. But these things are huge. These individual canisters and the structures can be over 100 tons. And so they are incredibly robust. And our regulator really ensures that they can survive, a whole range of concerns, natural disasters, other things. So, that's sort of the state of play of how we manage spent fuel in this country. But I think yes, it's spent fuel, and yes, it's nuclear waste, and we have to manage it. But I think it's really a highlight that we've done it safely and effectively with these sort of really simple engineering solutions for, 50, 60 years.
Well, as we know, it only takes little incidents to get blown up into a movie or two, and next thing you know, you got giant bees running around.
Yeah. So.
Gentlemen, I have a couple of follow-up questions I want to ask on this storage piece. And Don, I'm going to go back to what you were talking about initially as well about how the reactor operates. So if my understanding is correct, if I remember my engineering from the Naval Academy, the nuclear reaction that takes place creates heat. You have sort of intermingled water systems around the reactor that flash to steam. That water flashes to steam, which is not radiated at all. It's not connected directly to the radiation, and that drives the turbine that creates the electricity. But then you were is that correct, Don?
That's correct in a boiling water reactor.
Okay, yes. Boiling water reactor. So that's one example. That's one of the ones I remember from engineering. And I was a history major, so you have to cut me some slack here. I'm not a nuclear engineer. Josh, you were just talking about the wet storage initially out of the reactor itself. What is done with that water? Because obviously that water has been exposed to radiation. How is that water stored? And I'm assuming that water is continuously cooled through some sort of a separated system where you're giving off the heat and recooling the water to keep it cool.
Yeah. So maybe I'll just speak to that real quick, and Don, you jump in. But generally, all of our operating reactors have a pool, right? So that they still have that pool and the water's in there. They have a very robust filter system on the water to trap any potential particulate or basically irradiated material that could have gotten into the pool. So they have a specific filtration systems for those pools to collect anything. So the water continuously circulates. And yes, there is some heat exchangers to ensure basically the water stays cool at a certain, there's a very, again, it's a very well regulated process at these reactors. And so there's a very tight band for the temperature of those pools. And so the water, they keep it a very consistent temperature. The filtration systems ensures there's no contaminants in the water. And so if there is any sort of waste, the water stays really clean, but those filters are what actually gets traps any radioactive material. And that is properly managed. Generally, that material is there's different sort of types of nuclear waste. These are generally very low level waste. It's not incredibly radioactive, and so you can manage those and disposition that material appropriately.
Yeah, I would just say, when we talk about nuclear waste from the nuclear power plants, it's important to say that the vast majority is all low level waste, rags, uniforms, etc., and that is all sent off to landfills that are properly managed. So we're focusing on high level waste, fuel rods, And the way a fuel rod is designed is, if you remember as a kid, you know, you had those snakes that you would lit at Halloween, those little things. Yeah. That's about the size of a uranium fuel pellet.
Okay.
And you stack those in a rod that's about 13 feet, 15 feet tall, and that is clad in zirconium. And the idea is that none of the fission products will penetrate that cladding through operations, and it's that is put into the fuel pool. So the water in the fuel pool, if it would become contaminated, it would be due to slight perforations in the cladding, but that is highly managed and highly unlikely. I mean, when the water is in the fuel pool to inspect various aspects of the pool, we send divers into the water. So it's not a life-threatening situation in the water. And as Josh has pointed out, there are filters to keep that water clean, produces minimal waste, and those filters would then be disposed of either as low-level waste or something else.
And I have one other follow-up question on the storage piece. I know that there had been some discussion about opening up Yucca Mountain for permanent storage for nuclear waste in the U.S., but we've run into lots of issues about transporting nuclear fuel, safety concerns and whatnot, from the nuclear reactor sites, the power plants around the country, to Yucca Mountain. Where are we at in that process? Is that, I mean, Josh, you're sort of the expert on the nuclear fuels storage and transportation.
So I'll speak to Yucca, and then we can talk about some of the transport topics you brought up. So Yucca Mountain is it was sort of the plan for disposal of the material. This is not sort of long-term storage, but true disposal, deep underground, sort of get rid of this material, disposition. There was a lot of work done on Yucca Mountain. It was it's a site out in Nevada. Several decades, there was a lot of technical work done. There was a license submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The NRC reviewed that license, generally agreed that it technically could be done. But during that process, politically, it was stopped. Essentially, the state of Nevada was not supportive of Yucca Mountain, and as such, was able to essentially stop that from a political perspective, not a technical safety perspective, but really a public support of the state. So it's sort of on indefinite hold at the moment. There's no sort of active Yucca Mountain activities going on. But the idea for Yucca Mountain was that, you know, we have reactors across the country. The idea was, instead of having all this material at the reactors and very safe dry storage, but still dry storage nonetheless, they would bring that material to Yucca and bury them underground. But that's on pause for the moment. So let me speak to the transportation issues. As part of Yucca, of the Yucca Mountain project, there were transportation corridors and plans set up to move all this material. I would argue that transportation of this material has been done safely throughout the country for 50, 60 years. We've had over 2,500 shipments across the U.S. and probably tenfold that around the world. And so, again, the transportation systems, I talked about how robust those storage systems are. The NRC, the regulator, requires incredibly robust transportation packages to survive almost any sort of accident. So the testing that goes into design of those casks is amazing. They have to survive long fires, floods, impacts. There's some really interesting YouTube videos of trains actually hitting them and these casks and surviving. So they're really a robust system. From a safety perspective, I just don't, you know, I think that's something that maybe people against nuclear power bring up, but we have an excellent transportation safety record, much, much higher than sort of any other energy source. It's just really impressive how robust these packages would be for transport.
We're going to take a quick break for station ID. You're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. We're broadcasting from our studios in beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. I'm John Olson alongside my co-host Bruce Moreland, and we're talking to Dr. Josh Jarrell and Mr. Don Harker about nuclear power.
All right. So, Josh, let me ask you to start us off on this question. What is the state of play for nuclear reactors in America today? How many are there? How old are they? What generation? Things like information like that that people might want to have in the back of their minds as they're thinking about this issue.
Sure. So we started, again, we talked about this earlier, after World War II, nuclear started to kind of be of interest. Nuclear weapons, but also nuclear power and peaceful use of nuclear. And so we started really building reactors in the early 60s. Most of our current generation of reactors were 70s and maybe early 80s when they came online. So again, 50 plus years of nuclear experience. I think we've on the commercial side, I think something like 120 reactors may have operated over the last 50 years, we'll call it. Right now, we have 93 operating reactors, is my understanding. These are all basically what I'll call these light water reactors. Don mentioned this earlier. These are very large base load sort of reactors. And when I say baseload, they come online, they can produce maybe, you know, a 1,000 megawatts, which is a large amount of electricity, can power maybe up to, you know, maybe up to 1 million homes, depends on how much you need, maybe 500,000. Very large energy sources. And so we have 93 of these operating reactors, really impressive. The safety record's great. They've operated for 40, 50, 60 years. The hope is they'll continue to operate. Again, we talk about the regulator being very, very rigid, I guess. So they review the licenses to say how long the reactor can operate. Most are going to operate for about 60 years. Several are looking at operating for 80 years or longer. So that's sort of the history. I think we'll see our last two large reactors come online in 2023. These are the Vogtle sites out in Georgia. So one in early 2023 and one in late 2023. But we've generated, again, about 20% of the electricity in this country from nuclear power over the last, again, several decades.
Okay. I'd be curious. I'm gonna bring in an old technology. I'm going to bring in the B-52, which we have been retrofitting for decades. And some of those planes are being flown by the grandchildren of the original B-52 pilots. Are nuclear reactors like that? Are they very refurbishable and reusable?
I think definitely in the regulatory regime we have, all the critical components are inspected over time. A great deal is learned about how radiation affects the building materials in nuclear power plants. The NRC then has been extending licenses in 20-year increments. There is no technical reason why they cannot have the same history as the B-52 and go on and on and have improvements added to them throughout their lifespan.
Yeah. For our listeners, the B-52 is one of our large strategic bombers. I got a bunch of Navy guys here that I have to explain this stuff to.
So, Don, I'm going to ask you to comment on this next one, since you've been in the industry for 40 years. What are the impediments to building new nuclear reactors today? Does the current permitting process, does it make it too hard for utility companies to build new reactors? Can you give us a sense of what the process looks like right now, especially from maybe a cost-benefit analysis?
In the United States, just speaking in the United States, for commercial nuclear power plants, the NRC is tasked with ensuring, public safety and that these are operated and designed properly. And they have a very robust process that people have to go through. So it is not surprising that it would take 5 to 10 years to get a design certified by the NRC. The most recent one to be certified is the New Scale SMR. We'll talk about that later. But the Koreans went through the process, and they got a 1,400 megawatt plant certified. But, you know, there are no customers now. So the advantage that other energy sources, specifically natural gas, wind and solar, is they can be designed, permitted, and in operation in less than half the time it takes to get a nuclear power plant design approved. It has not always been that way. When the atomic age started in the U.S., the Atomic Energy Commission, through Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program, we built approximately 20 reactors in this country between 1953 and 1967. One of them was even built in Elk River, Minnesota. And so at that point in time, the regulatory process was less bureaucratic, for lack of a better word. But it's important to also note that the Department of Defense and Department of Energy in this country have the capability to license their own reactors. So what's going on right now, there's a thing called Project Pele, where DOD and DOE are building a transportable mobile reactor, and it is designed, built, operated, and tested within 3 years. So the engineering knowledge and the skill is there to do things much faster. At this point in time, there is a impediment. Well, I won't say an impediment. A hurdle that some developers find it easier to go to Canada to develop their reactors than do it in the U.S.
I'm going to jump in real quick with a political question then. I often hear that we're going to simplify the permitting process, and I think a lot of people think that we're talking about permitting for things like high-power transmission lines and stuff like that. Is the nuclear industry also waiting with bated breath for that simplification of the permitting process, or is that not being addressed there?
Well, I think the nuclear industry thought they simplified the permitting process when they developed something called 10 CFR 52. Most reactors in this country were developed under a two-part process where you apply for the construction permit, you built the plant, and then you went before a board to get an operating license. The Shoreham plant, which was built and never operated, showed the weakness of that regulatory scheme when the local community refused to participate in emergency planning activities. The Vogtle plants are being built under TENS 52, which was supposedly the simplified process. But we have found that that process locked in the design. So when you have first-of-a-kind plants that have never been built, it is a large leap of faith that you have designed everything properly and it will be put together properly. And if it was not built exactly according to plan, you have to go to the NRC to get licensing amendments. So it tends to slow the process down. I don't know if I addressed your question, but yes, there was an attempt to simplify that.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, let me remind everybody that they're listening to Public Policy This Week on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1 from our studios in still beautiful downtown Northfield, Minnesota. I'm Bruce Moreland, and my co-host for today's show is John Olson, and we're talking to Don Harker and Dr. Josh Jarrell, who are both experts on nuclear power.
Gentlemen, let's shift over to talking about these small modular reactors. Don, you mentioned the NuScale reactor. The U.S. Navy has been using nuclear power for many decades with an extremely safe record. What advantages are there for small modular reactors to power cities? We ask this question in light of the fact that we need stable, reliable sources of power to maintain the electrical grid, which can be supplemented by wind and solar, including stored electricity. But clean renewables at scale are still kind of maybe decades away from providing all of our electricity needs. We also know we need to combat climate change by tackling the production of CO2. And nuclear power seems to meet that critical need. What can you tell us about these new small modular reactors? Don, we'll start with you and then shift over to you, Josh.
Okay. Well, I would just as a point of interest, you know, I mentioned the power reactor development program, the Atoms for Peace, when we built approximately 20 reactors between 52 and 67, all of various vintages. But all of those were of different styles. So while the light water reactor won out, there were high-temperature gas reactors built during that period of time. There were molten salt reactors built during that period of time. And all of the new designs for SMRs can trace a legacy to some of those previous ones. Those were all small plants. So in some respects, we're coming full circle to what was maybe tested before, but now with more advanced technology, better engineering, understanding of things like that. The light water reactor basically, some would argue the light water reactor became the reactor of choice just because the first plant was Shippington that was built, and the nuclear Navy funded a lot of development for the light water reactors. The high temperature gas reactors, for example, the X energy reactor, there were prototypes built for Fort St. Vrain, PICO 1. Those reactors produce superheated steam, which is advantageous for the production of power and process heat. There are molten salt reactors, which use a different style. So I think one of the most interesting ones that's being developed is the Westinghouse eVinci, which is a heat pipe reactor measured in the hundreds of kilowatt range, which you could basically power a building. So the advantages of the modularity is that you can create a factory, an assembly line process, transport these to a site, build them quickly, and get them operating. I think I rambled there, but
no, that's good. No, Josh, any additional comments on the SMRs?
SMRs, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I sort of gave the state of play of the commercial industry right now. I think smaller is the future. I don't think we'll ever build, or maybe at least for the next several decades, these large 1,000-megawatt sort of plants. And the reason is we're sort of right-sizing it. Don brought up, you know, you may only need enough power for a small city of 50,000. You don't need, a million people, a million homes worth of electricity. And so going smaller makes a lot of sense. It helps with the initial economics. So you don't have to put as much money down to build a huge the smaller plants are not as expensive as a big, large plant. And you can sort of build them in a modular fashion, as Don mentioned, and deploy them quickly. So if you have a town of 50,000, you build a small modular reactor. And if you double in size or you get a couple key businesses to move in, you add another one. And so just that sort of modular, flexible approach, I think, is really where the future is. I mean, all of them use different, more advanced materials, more advanced technologies, all the things that we've learned related to sort of, better deployment of the technology. But, the key is just they're flexible and they can be used for different things. I think Don brought up, process heat. You could use them to desalinate. You could use them to deploy and recover from a natural disaster if they're transportable. Don mentioned a couple of those. And so there's a whole range of technologies that could be deployed, and they're all smaller. Smaller is the way of the future. I think I'm really excited about where we go. I think the really small ones, the transportable ones, the DOD, the Project Pele that Don brought up, those are reactors that we could deploy in the next couple of years. And so just seeing that, I think, is really exciting.
And I think an interesting aspect is that as you go smaller, private industry is interested in it, and they can do this on their own without their utilities. So you see Dow Chemical and X Energy signing an agreement to build a reactor on the Gulf Coast to provide process heat to a Dow Chemical facility. You see interest in the Canadian gold mines wanting a reactor of some type up there so they don't have to fly in diesel fuel. Mm-hmm. You see the U.S. Air Force wanting to put a small eVinci, maybe 1 megawatt, multiple megawatt reactor at the Air Force Base, at Ellison Air Force Base in Alaska. Nuclear power is the only source where you can get rid of the transmission system.
You don't need
a transmission system.
That's a really good point. I love the phrase right sizing. It used to be every city had their own power plant, a coal-fired power plant with piles of coal ash and all that to deal with. But you're saying we'll have these, like a manufactured home, but for nuclear power. That's pretty cool. All right, well, thank you.
Josh, go ahead.
Can I just, I just wanted to just, you know, maybe add one more thing to that, that right sizing. You know, you could potentially take a small reactor, take it with fuel, put it into a city, and it could operate for 10 years and power that city without any logistical, you know, shipping diesel in, no worries. You know, it's basically a purpose-built battery that comes, deploys, you pick it back up after 10 years and you put a new one in. I mean, it's really sort of life-changing for some of these small cities, bases, other places. So I think there's some real excitement and some real benefit to the right size.
It's a brave new future we've got looking at it.
I'm going to comment one thing. Bruce mentioned that I host National Security This Week, so my brain is spinning right now about all these things that you're talking about with these small modular reactors. One of the things that I had heard about when I was on the Navy staff in the early phases of the war in Iraq was that the Army, all of their supply lines were being targeted by the insurgents. And so you had all these fuel trucks that were driving around, which had incredibly bad fuel mileage because of the poor designs. But they were being targeted by the insurgents because all of the operating bases that the U.S. Army had established all across Iraq needed these constant supplies of fuel to fuel all the, you know, the combat vehicles, to fuel the generators and everything else. And so what you're really talking about is this ability to modularize and very quickly to provide electrical power to forward operating bases. And one of the things that's really fascinating to me right now as I follow these trends in the military is that the military is starting to test a lot of electric vehicles for high mobility in the combat zone. So if you have a forward operating base that's powered fully by a small modular reactor, not only are you powering the base, but you can charge up all of those electric combat vehicles that are then going to go out on patrol or engage the enemy very, very quickly. So this is fascinating stuff that you're talking about. Thank you for filling us in on these small modular reactors.
I think they're really exciting, and I love the idea of Northfield having its own fission system running. But speaking of fission, I'm going to talk over to fusion. Back when I was a young launch officer, I was writing a research paper on nuclear fusion. And for the listeners, fusion energy comes from fusing small atoms and getting energy out of that, as opposed to splitting large atoms and getting energy out. And it seems like fusion power has been a decade away for the last 50 years. I was wondering if you've heard anything or if you have any insights on what we might expect from fusion as we move forward.
Well, I actually had the opportunity to work on a fusion project several years ago, and it was very interesting, the infrastructure that this company was developing and testing their container. As you point out, in fusion energy, you know, it's the same energy that's found in the sun. The question is, you need to contain the energy after the helium hydrogen atoms are crushed together and, you know, basically create a little artificial sun and an electromagnetic field on Earth. In the United States, we have now through deregulation, we have a competitive market for fuel, for electric energy. So the question for fusion is, you know, I can't answer when it will show up. I can't answer if it will show up. When I got in the industry, fuel cells were just around the corner, and they're still just around the corner. But the question is, after the technical problems are solved, is can you make it a going concern in a competitive energy market? Mm. So if you have something that's a high capital cost and a cheap fuel, which is essentially nuclear, you're not going to be able to compete against fission SMRs. You're not going to be able to compete against solar. You're not going to be able to compete against wind. So, you know, there's the technical problem, and then there's the business problem. So I think that's all to be determined.
Yeah, and a fusion reactor is going to be large scale. So yeah, no doubt. Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably agree with Don. I think we're still a little ways out on fusion. I think there is still some significant technical material confinement sort of questions around fusion energy, and then it's how do you actually deploy it and fit it into this broader energy portfolio here in the U.S. and around the world. You know, from my perspective, I think fission, I need to get clean energy in the next 10 years, and fission's the way to do that. And you know, I think fusion is probably, you know, it's very interesting and it has a lot of benefits if we could deploy it from a technical perspective, but we're not there yet. But we do have a really good handle on the fission and nuclear energy from that side.
So I have a couple of other follow-up questions that I'll ask you, since it seems like fission is the way to go for the future until some major breakthrough happens that we have a long-term fusion reaction. Because I think the longest they've been able to achieve one so far is about 30 seconds. Is that right, Josh and Don? About a 30-second fusion reaction?
Yeah. It was very short. I don't know if it was even that long, I'm not an expert.
Okay, fair enough. I read in an article as we were preparing for this show that some of the challenges that we face is that the fuel that's needed to create these, the fuel cells or the fuel for the fission reaction systems, some of that comes from Russia, that the supply chain comes from Russia. And with the situation now, the geopolitical situation, that we're potentially going to have some trouble getting that supply because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, I also know that there are some movements in the nuclear industry to try and take decommissioned nuclear weapons from the U.S. inventory in the Department of Energy and shift those back over to potentially being supply sources. Do I have that wrong? Did that article lie to me? Where do we stand on the supply line for fuel for the fission reactions?
Well, I mean, a great deal of the uranium does come from Russia. In the past, I mean, Australia is a source, Kazakhstan is a source, so the U.S. is a source. The advanced reactors require something called high assay, low enrichment fuel, mm-hmm. where today's reactors run about 5% or lower enrichment, meaning how much U-235 they have. The HALO fuel will be about 20% enrichment. The ground has just been broken on the factory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to start making some of that. So supply chain is an issue today, but there are other sources of supply for uranium. Uranium is pretty inexpensive at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think that, supply issues can be solved. The bigger issues perhaps might be, you know, who can fabricate steel, who can fabricate these components that need to be put into the reactors to the quality standards they're done. It's unfortunate that the U.S. has lost a lot of capability to make things. And so we rely on our allies to help fabricate a lot of these components.
Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll echo Don's concern about capabilities for fabrication. I think that's going to be a key driver to show that we can effectively deploy some of these small modular reactors in the next few years, is, you know, fabrication capabilities. As far as the uranium, I'll just maybe speak to that. You know, in the enrichment level, the amount of U-235 is key. So the current fleet, again, is about 5%. These advanced reactors are going to be probably up to 20% enriched. And so while we may have uranium, the process of enriching it is challenging. And so the capabilities there is still lacking in this country. And so there's actually been some congressional direction just recently start trying to get some basically federal dollars to encourage private industry to really ramp up its capabilities to make this higher enriched uranium. So it's starting. I think we're going to, you know, it's sort of a chicken and egg question. Do we have the fuel for these advanced reactors, and how does that happen? But, you know, it's definitely on everybody's radar, and we're moving forward. Across the U.S., there are some small amounts of these materials that may be available, but at large scale, I think it's still an unknown how we're going to get this higher enriched uranium.
I have one last follow-up question for you, and then we're going to have to probably close out the show. Unfortunately, we're almost at the end of our hour. Both of you have your finger on the pulse of the nuclear industry. Are you seeing, from a policy perspective, coalescing around the idea of greater support from political leaders on both sides of the aisle for nuclear power, considering the challenges of climate change?
Oh, I would say definitely. I mean, I think one of the biggest striking examples of that is California, Diablo Canyon. You know, people were agitating very vigorously to shut the plant down, and now they find that, you know, just through the path their energy policies have followed, if they are going to meet their climate goals as a state, they need nuclear power. So I think that is the most dramatic reversal that we've seen. And I think that if you contrast, if you look at Germany, who went all renewables early in, mandated it, they're burning lignite coal to stabilize their grid, and the cost of energy is out the door. Mm-hmm. So if for political leadership in this country, if you want to keep the price of electricity down, you're probably going to need nuclear power.
Yeah, I'll just say yes, absolutely. You're seeing support on both sides of that, both parties of nuclear power. It supports clean energy. It's safe. It's reliable. You know, when you see things where, you know, electric grids go down in natural disasters and you know, you're missing that base load, you know, you see a lot more people sort of awake to the idea of, oh, man, we really need some of these more reliable energy sources domestically. So it's a combination of the clean energy, but the reliability as well. So, yeah, we're seeing a lot of support.
Gentlemen, unfortunately, we're closing out the end of the show today. Another hour has flown by here on Public Policy This Week. This has been a great conversation, but we have to bring it to a close. We only have so much time each Friday morning. Don Harker and Dr. Josh Jarrell, Bruce and I want to thank you for your time and expertise today. If either of you have any closing comments to make, here's your opportunity. Don, I'll let you go first.
Well, just thank you for the opportunity to talk about a very interesting topic. It's near and dear to my heart.
And Josh?
I would say the same. It was great chatting with you this morning. I'm a huge proponent of nuclear energy. I think it's an exciting time in the field, and I think it'll be a game changer over the next couple of decades here in the U.S. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, thank you both, gentlemen.
Yes, thank you both. It's been a great conversation. And that will conclude this week's edition of Public Policy This Week. We're on KYMN Radio AM 1080 and FM 95.1 each Friday morning from 10 to 11 a.m. I'm Bruce Moreland, and my co-host today has been John Olson. Public service announcement, don't forget to vote next Tuesday, November 8th, and then join us next Friday as we consider the impact of public policy from the choices voters have made on that election day.
Folks, please tell your family and friends about Public Policy This Week. It is our hope this show serves as a catalyst for you to have important, meaningful, in-depth conversations about public policy challenges and opportunities. Together, we can seek comprehensive, integrated solutions to the many challenges we face in our shared society.
Thank you for joining us today on Public Policy This Week. We hope you'll join our show again next Friday morning at 10 a.m. Have a fantastic Friday and a superb weekend.
You've been listening to Public Policy This Week. Tune in every Friday morning at 10 a.m. for more conversation with policy experts. Remember, this show can be found on your favorite podcast platform or stream it from kymnradio.net.